might be used, we can generate probabilistic heat maps of Will's estimated location based on his mobile phone usage. And so at a different time, so at midnight here, I imagine this is very wide because he's actually not emitting signals at this time of night. But if we go to a different time of day, and in fact, if we look throughout the day, 2 a.m. he's still asleep. By this time, there's a bit more activity. By this time, more. And if we get to here, he's clearly in one of two locations. So there's still probabilistic heat maps based on the data towers that are being used. By 11 p.m, it's getting pretty clear where he is. So we know that he's somewhere up here. He's actually not down here. One of the other sources of information that came from his phone, they would not give out the IP addresses of people he contacted, but we could easily work out who his top 10 contacts were. So all of their names have been obscured, but here we see the number of calls and the number of messages made to different individuals. And if we look at the locations of those, so we have in blue the phone messages and in orange the SMS messages, we can see that he makes contact with different people, and he certainly has a very strong connection with Hobart. He sends a lot of phone calls go down there. There's also quite a few messages between friends and contacts more locally, but Hobart's coming back here again in the SMS messages. So clearly, you know, we could infer something about his longer range relationships from this than we could from just looking at the patterns of his movements. And this is a demonstration of what metadata can tell about us. So in sending a text message or in making a phone call, the actual content of the conversation or the message is the data. The metadata is the stuff that's emitted around the edges of it, but it gives us additional information about this individual and also some information about his contacts. So it's just a nice, explicit demonstration of the sorts of things we're talking about. And anyone who wants to follow that up, I can send you the link. So what is the purpose of digital data? And this is an interesting issue from an ethical point of view. So data may be collected for a specific purpose, and that can be with or without consent. And depending on whether data is collected with consent or without consent, we already have approaches to thinking about it. But a lot of the data that's emitted by devices isn't actually collected with any specific purpose. So the fact that you need to access a phone tower is just a fact of nature, but it's not for any purpose that you access that phone tower that someone knows where you are. So some of the information that is out there was never collected with any thought in mind, so how do we determine the appropriateness of its use for one purpose or another? Also, as mentioned, we see a lot of administrative data sets and other things that we're quite familiar with in research, but we might see new uses of those data if we can combine them with other data. Or purposeless data may be meaningful when combined with other forms of information. And so these new uses may only become apparent over time. We might not even have envisaged that they could be used for this reason. But particularly with linkage, information can become much more useful and valuable. And in fact, in the commercial sector, data bundles that are generated in this way are very valuable commodities. So, you know, the more information you have about your customers or consumers, the more you can pitch to their specific needs. And of course, this gives us great opportunities. The repurposing of available information is highly cost efficient, and we would say we actually have an ethical imperative to use the information that's available in the most effective way to assist human health and society, and that to squander information is a loss. So how do we make the most of that potential efficiency? How do we use the data that's there rather than, you know, putting up to the NHMRC for yet another one of the 12% of studies that will be funded to collect vast arrays of knowledge when in fact it's already there? And depending on the source, some of these data sets can represent very large population samples that allow you to make, you know, assessments with much greater precision, provided that you can be sure of the accuracy and validity of the data. One of the particular challenges but opportunities in this area is that many forms of data are spatially referenced, and so this is very important in being able to define small area questions, particularly as our society becomes more and more heterogeneous and we see different movements of people through the population. Being able to address some of these small area questions is highly valuable, but what are the potential risks to privacy in getting information down to quite small spatial locations? So here are the challenges. How do we weigh the social benefits in all ethical propositions? We must consider the social benefits against potential risks. One of the challenges here is, can we actually envisage all the potential risks? So there's a nice story here of a colleague of mine who had a great app that, you know, every day he could see how far he was riding his bike because his app would actually measure how far he was going. And about 6 months into using this app, there was a major upgrade, and the app developers actually, you know, let everybody know that they were having to make a change because this app would enable anybody who could visualise it to know exactly when you left home every morning and when your house was now vacant. So one of the responses of this was to slightly perturb your starting location every day so that it wasn't actually clear where you were leaving from, but you could still measure your distance travelled. So, you know, wasn't foreseen at the start, great idea, but actually there's a potential risk, and so a modification needs to be made. And there are many such stories of researchers only realising a little further down the track that there might be a problem that they hadn't foreseen. And in the researchers we've been talking to in this area, people just want that shared knowledge. They want to see the pitfalls before they fall into them to prevent problems from arising. One of the other big challenges, and we worked a lot with CSIRO, as I'll tell you, but one of the challenges here is that we're actually trying, in many of these instances, we're taking digital data that's created in one sort of environment and context, and people who work in that environment have a very particular view and approach to data and information, and we're trying to use a lot of that information to address complex social and health questions. And sociological and health researchers tend to have a very different view of data and the participant in data. And we found, and others have found, that part of the challenge, and this was all highly relevant to the Carlton Connect initiative, which funded this research, which is all about merging sociology and technology, is that a lot of the problems that arise are actually about the clash of cultures as well as the actual technological issues involved. So, you know, someone who is very into the development of sensors sees absolutely no issue with, you know, collecting individual data points on thousands of individuals and merging them together. Someone else is much more concerned about the individual in the data, and this conceptualisation of the participant generates immediate anaphylaxis in both camps. And one is trying to wonder what your problem is with the ethics, and the other is trying to, you know, countenance your reduction of an individual to a data point. And those sorts of things actually become quite influential in the conversation. The question that we have is how adequate existing ethical guidelines are to inform research activity in this area. And the NHMRC guidelines are very much geared around clinical trials type of research, and they think about things in that way, as we'll come through when we talk about the issues. Clearly, technologies are emerging rapidly, and so no one set of guidelines can preempt all of the challenges that may arise or the technologies yet to be created. But can we come to some overview of the overarching issues that help us to define some usable frameworks and guidelines to move forward into this area? So where did we begin? Well, how did I get involved in this as someone who's a lapsed paediatrician, now runs a computational and mathematical modelling group and informs government policy, and here I am doing some ethics guidelines? Well, it came out of need, it's a nationally, internationally recognised need, and we basically got on the bandwagon of a conversation that was already bubbling up. So in December 2013, I'd been funded by the Carlton Connect Initiative here at the University of Melbourne that merges sociology and technology to solve complex social problems. And we put up incubator grant application on building an evidence base to support planning for socially connected, equitable communities. And so I had a whole lot of people who came into the room who were sort of from the sociological side, had questions about social heterogeneity and urban planning and how do you build cities to get people together. I had the techie people who were great on developing sensors or involved in geomatics, looking at spatially referenced technologies and, you know, collecting data efficiently. And we had people from the community, people working in the public sector, in social housing and in various government departments. Thought, right, let's get all these people in the room, let's find out what the real burning questions are, let's find the conceptual frameworks to pose questions and the technology to solve them. And we had a really great day. We got a lot of people in the room. It was very active. There were lots of diverse perspectives. We started to see some of these cultural challenges, but also, you know, a dialogue through them. But at the end of the day, you know, we had a lot of really good new connections, but most of what we'd identified were barriers to research in this area. And one of the really key issues that came up was ethics and privacy concerns around the use of spatially referenced data and also, you know, metadata and emitted data, big data, in this way. And what was clear from the conversations was that there was very variable knowledge of risks and opportunities among researchers, among ethics committee members and the public. And we had some sort of frank and fearless stories of researchers saying, well, yes, I put this application in and I got it through, but maybe I really shouldn't have. Or other people telling stories of applications they'd put in that had been blocked by the committee. And one in particular was researchers from Singapore, where there's been resurgence or marked increase in dengue fever. And so they put a proposal into the Ethics Committee to have participants, with their consent, release their mobile phone records for the 2 weeks prior to being admitted with dengue fever to understand where they'd been in Singapore, to understand where this reservoir might be, and by looking at people's overlap, to understand where the vectors were. That was refused by the Ethics Committee because they were concerned that some people might have visited the red light district and that might become public or become known, and that might be very awkward and embarrassing for them, so they didn't feel that was appropriate. But they did tell the researchers that they could ask people to consent and they could then collect their information for the next 2 weeks after they went home from hospital, and they could turn their phone off at any time, which to me was a totally unethical proposal because then you're collecting all this personal information about people that can't possibly address the question. So these sorts of stories, everyone had their frustrating story, everyone had their slightly guilty story of, you know, how they had experienced ethics committees and the problems that they'd run into that they hadn't expected to find. Also among the public, one of the big issues is this whole question of metadata. So many people are just totally unaware of the information that they're generating all the time. And in starting to spell out some of these issues and think about the questions, you know, what we really identified was a need for better public knowledge and education and communication about some of these forms of data. You know, how many people who have their flybys know that that's a way to advertise to them, or, you know, once they're buying petrol with it, that, you know, a car insurer can know exactly where you travel and how far. Your health insurer knows what you really eat, even if you lie about it. You know, or what are all these other forms of information and what financial and other implications might they have for us? And as we said, the current NHMRC guidelines are very focused on sort of face-to-face interactions. There are guidance documents about administrative data sets and other things. But where we're getting into some of these other issues about provision and self-generated information, we felt that further guidance was needed, and we're not alone in thinking that. So coming out of the workshop, some of the people who'd been involved in that, particularly Marilise Gilliman and Deb Waugh and Jenny Waycott and Assunta Hunter, had been involved in the development of a set of guidelines for ethical visual research methods. So they kind of had a little paradigm for how to start to address these questions. So they were the first people I went to and said, well, would you be interested in helping to do this? And we were very generously awarded a small amount of funding by Jim McCluskey, which I have to say was probably the best investment in my research career so far, because I don't think I've ever been asked to talk about anything quite so much as these guidelines, which have been very widely disseminated. So it was great. So working with that group, we set up a series of workshops, and Carlton Connect Initiative supported us with that. We got together with some other experts, so Karen Clark from Law, Matt Duckham, who's a Professor of Geomatics, Richard Sinnott, who's Head of E-Research here at the University, Stephen Prower from the Melbourne Materials Institute, who's very active in developing sensor technologies, and from CSIRO, Christine O'Keefe, who's on the Office of the Information Commissioner and has an expressed research interest in developing new privacy technologies, and Cathy Pitkin, who's a research ethics officer there, who has a lot of interface with their researchers through the Ethics Committee process. So we got a really diverse group of people to represent all of these perspectives and some lessons learned from CSIRO. And we held a series of workshops where we purposively sort of snowballed our contacts and invited other people who had a specific interest in this area. So we ran two workshops and we did those in different ways around issues and scenarios. Assunta was our project officer and she also went around and interviewed sort of key people around the university, which was great. And at the end of all of that, that was distilled into a set of guidelines and a paper that's near submission. So we tried to get as many perspectives as possible, and this is why I say I'm the instigator of this project, because I learned a great deal from the many people who were involved. So what did we identify? And I'm going to go through a series of areas where challenges occur, but the boundaries between them are fuzzy and sort of one thing starts to lead into another from time to time. But I just want to distill some of the key concepts and issues that we did find. So the first is that of consent. So clearly in the NHMRC context, informed consent involves the provision of information and some time for cooling off and the opportunity to talk to other people and a face-to-face process. And where individuals are involved in ongoing participation in a clinical trial, at each point of that trial, at each interface with the researcher, there's the opportunity to revisit the terms of consent and the person's willingness to participate. In an online environment, we give consent to handing over our information for very many reasons. We consent to providing our personal information to purchase a product, to access information, to find out, you know, something about goods and services. And so we have in our minds a value proposition around the terms of consent. I am sure that you, like me, assiduously read the 60 pages of text that come with all of those consents, and I don't know how many of them I tick in a given week. But, you know, how do we, in a digital environment, how do we, even where individuals have consented to their information being handed over, how do we feel reasonably confident that they understood the purpose of information use and that the purpose for which we're proposing to use their information is in accord with that and is acceptable, and in particular that it does not pose any risks to the participant? There was a very nice demonstration of this in the Age Odd Spot last year of a cafe in London which offered its patrons access to free wireless internet in exchange for accepting the terms and conditions. And in a single morning, six people had consented to hand over their firstborn child. So I don't know that that was enforced or enforceable, but it did make the point that we don't read, and how do we make sure that people understand? That's the baby. The issues of privacy and confidentiality become more challenging here as well. So obviously privacy is the legal definition of an individual being able to control who has access to their information, and confidentiality is that maintenance that only authorised people should have access to personal information. And so much of what we do is so much more visible, but this is difficult, and particularly with the aggregation and linkage of information, information that by itself might be quite unidentifiable might become re-identifiable as more items are brought together. And so this is a particular challenge in this area. The fair information principles, or the information privacy principles, is actually what most of the discussion in this area is based around. And I think it's very forward-looking that they're based on a document produced in 1974 by the US Department of Health, Education and Welfare. And these principles are still carried forward as the basis for this privacy discussion. So those principles, the practices are that individuals who are providing their information or whose information is to be used are given notice, and that there's transparency about the use of information, that there is appropriate consent and use limitations, so there are boundaries on how information is used, that individuals are encouraged to have access and participation, that there's integrity and security of information use, but also there's enforcement and accountability when information is not being used well. And this is a particularly interesting point in Australia because Richard Sinnott, who's our head of e-research, who's worked widely in Europe and set up data linkage systems with the NHS and many other health-related, study groups and so on, yeah, everything there was about enforcement. Everything had to be documented, everything had to be notified. In Australia, our enforcement is very limited. So this whole process of accountability and enforcement is something that's certainly likely to increase in the future, but at the moment Australia is well behind in making sure that people do actually comply with these. And when we looked at these, I mean, one of the discussions that came up a lot in the workshops was it's all very well to think about new forms of information and everything else, but how well are people managing the data they have now? They collect on paper surveys and stick into an Excel spreadsheet and put on their laptop. You know, so these sort of principles are useful, and this sort of discussion is useful in really revisiting all of our research and the way that we're conducting that and making sure that we are indeed preserving privacy and doing our duty to ensure confidentiality. The other big issue in this area, particularly where information might be collected without purpose or without apparent purpose, is the issue of ownership and authorship. And a lot of the concerns in this space are not even so much about what the question is, but it's who's asking the question. And it amazes me that we have such faith in multinationals to know everything about us and use it for our good, but the instant the government wants to know it, we're suspicious. So there is this huge disconnect in the way people perceive the threat to themselves depending on who is accessing the information and who is asking the question. And the authorship thing becomes a lot more blurry. So this was a big issue, for example, in the visual research methods that, you know, people have authorship over their creative product, but, you know, there's this real blurring between public and private and what is an individual's creative product, you know, when they're writing on Facebook or blogs or other places. You know, what is their ownership of that information? They've made it accessible in the public domain, but it still is attributable to that person. I also found this infographic, which was quite amusing, I suppose, about the three types of consumers. So obviously this was based on robust research, but it described individuals as data pragmatists who are willing to share their data as long as they believe there's reasonable benefit, the data fundamentalists who don't want to tell anybody anything about themselves, and those who are completely unconcerned. And one of the interesting things I hear said a lot in this area that actually concerns me is that many people of my age and above will simply say, well, you know, the younger generation, they're not concerned about privacy, so we don't even have to worry about it. It's going to be all over in the next 10 years. Now, it's clear we have lost our privacy. You know, this information is all out there about us, but does that mean it's unimportant, or does that mean that we don't have to be concerned about it? And Rufus Black, you know, feels that we've been morally naive in just sort of handing over our privacy, and there's not been enough reflection about what that process is. And so, you know, it'll be interesting to see how the conversation develops over the next 10 to 20 years, but I'm certainly not of the camp that says, well, we don't have to care. So all of this really is, I think, a place for much more public discussion and debate, as well as, you know, care in the research community. Like, governance and custodianship are big issues in this area. So data governance has many aspects. One of them is data provenance. Do we know where data have come from, and can we be sure about the conditions around which it was provided? So particularly as data are bundled together and sold on commercially as products, how confident are we that all of the sources, all of the primary holders of information have provided full consent and that that's been used properly? Obviously, the backup of data happens remotely now in many, many places. We don't even necessarily know where the information's being held by the time it's been backed up on some server somewhere in Finland or something, I don't know. How do we keep track of information? The whole notion of destroying the information, I just laugh every time I tick that form of the Ethics Committee box, because how do we destroy information that's out there and being backed up in so many places we can't possibly know? And then there's the issue of access. So that's the confidentiality part. How do we govern access to information? And this is where I think there are huge opportunities in this area, because there are many individuals for whom that is a separate research activity. Christine O'Keefe was one, and she's worked extensively with the ABS, for instance, to work on preserving privacy in their information release, to the extent of obviously aggregation of data and various things like that are one way of limiting information, deliberately perturbing data where there are very small numbers of observations so that it can't be accurately referenced back to a particular place or location in small data sets. And the notion that access has to be a grayscale. It's not you're a trusted person so you can know everything and we don't trust you so you can't have it, but there has to be this gradation of information availability, and the ways to provide that can be very technological solutions to providing access control and monitoring data flow that actually help us to develop a more nuanced way of thinking about information use. Participant-led research is another interesting area in this whole environment, because individuals are generating information. There are people who publish yearbooks on themselves. I don't know if you've ever browsed these kind of websites, but you know, there's this guy who puts out an annual report on himself every year, and it's all of his data and all of his activities, and he puts them all together because, you know, he thinks that might be useful to science in some way. But on a smaller scale, you know, many people voluntarily participate in information sharing exercises. There's a great one which is it tracks people's healthy eating practices by time of day, so you get this sort of global map of who's eating what when, and everybody gets up and does really, really well. They're all eating green food at the start of the day. There's little green lights everywhere, and then by lunchtime it's sort of getting into yellow, and by 10 o'clock at night we're all in the munchies and eating red. Yeah, but people are generating this sort of information, and it's out there, and some people are doing it in smaller or larger groups. And how do ethics committees look on that, and how do they interact with those participants who are saying, well, we actually want to ask our own questions and this is what we want to know? So it gets the whole sort of balance of who's the researcher and who's the participant into a slightly different conversation. Clearly, the research needs to consider the value proposition. So what is the benefit to society of doing research, and any even potential risks to individuals need to be balanced by those benefits. And in many cases, a lot of people say, well, what are the real risks? I mean, you know, what really happens? Well, there are very few instances of misuse of information that has led to real harm. But we still need to be sure that we're doing research that is socially beneficial. And that, I think, that also is a large part of the conversation with the public. So in understanding what forms of information exist around them and how can they be used, I think there's a case not only for researchers but for journalists and others to be out there doing that. And Margaret Simons, who heads the Centre for Advancing Journalism here, has a data journalism group. So she teaches data journalism in her course, but she also interacts with a lot of data journalists from The Guardian and other media outlets around Australia. And there's been some great work there, you know. So there was a piece on bicycle accidents in Victoria. And so they started off by scraping the VicRoads website and finding out, you know, where accidents were reported, but then they asked people to send in their own data on you know, bicycle car accidents. And so people augmented that public data set with their own reports and stories, and that was used to generate a map of Victoria to tell cyclists where the hazard spots were and where the safe paths were. And that was a clear feedback exercise of saying to people, you know, you provide us with your information and it's there to benefit you and to help you to develop safer cycling practices. So those sorts of examples are really powerful in helping people to understand the potential positive uses of data. And it's up to us to help to sell those stories. There is an international data sharing code of conduct, and its whole purpose is to promote greater access to and use of data. And again, in the way of the information privacy principles, you know, there've got to be some basic principles associated with that. So firstly, that it should be equitable, that it should recognise and balance the needs of researchers and other analysts, communities and funders. And this is an interesting challenge because I've been to a few big data type meetings recently where people have got up and said, well, that's fine for all the people who have smartphones, but how is your research going to serve and access the individuals who don't have access to these emerging technologies? You know, and is this actually going to be equitable research if there's a proportion of the population that's excluded? So this is a slightly different angle, but I think it's an important one. Data sharing should be ethical, so protecting individual privacy, community dignity, while improving public health, and also efficient. So it's demonstrating that this is improving the quality and value of research, that it's building on existing practice and not just duplicating. And there is a huge enthusiasm at the moment, and we get people approaching us, you know, and someone else wants to get mobile phone records and understand people's interactions, and there's been a lot of activity around this. I think we need to be sure that we understand what the questions are, what the information can really tell us, do we have the appropriate context to interpret it, and what are its applications and uses. In fact, there was an international thing to release a whole lot of phone records, and I think it had to be pulled because there were some issues around it. But yeah, so all of these sort of, you know, contests and things for how people can use information most effectively are out there, but we need to be sure that we're being careful. So what we ended up doing in the document provided was trying to distill this down into a set of guidelines for ethics committees, and I was reporting that I was quite relieved not long after we finished this. One of my postdocs was submitting an ethics application that was around the use of spatially aggregated information on influenza reports, and he's saying, oh, now what is it I need to answer here? I said, take the book, read this. You know, you have to say this about the actual, you know, data holdings, this about, you know, who's doing access control and how we're monitoring it. And it was actually quite useful. So it that was proof of the pudding for me that it was of some kind of benefit because it took up my postdoc off my back. But he was able to use that then to frame responses and to reassure the Ethics Committee that we had thought through the relevant issues and that we did have the appropriate controls and so on in place. So we just basically posed a set of questions really for committees to help to guide them through the process of review. So in firstly understanding the information to be used, were the data in the study collected through digital devices, collected online, repurposed from another project, or self-generated participant data? So it's just thinking about forms of information that might not traditionally have always been up there. And one of the interesting things with collected online, people tell you stories, you know, a researcher who said, oh yeah, she was developing this, you know, confidential online survey and the software developers are working on it. They said, oh, so do you want the metadata with that? So the fact that we can gain more information than our participants want to tell us, I don't think ethically we should, but even just being prepared for that question I think is quite important. Will the data used or generated in the study be amenable to renegotiation of consent? So where people have provided consent, can you go back? Is it possible? Will it enable identification of individuals or groups? And will it include private or potentially harmful information? And so as we say, the actual risks of harm are quite small, but again, everyone has an anecdote. So you may have heard of the teenager in the US who received a catalogue from Target in the post. She was 16, and the Target catalogue included lots and lots of special offers and information about baby products. And her father got this catalogue and was furious and, you know, got on the phone to Target and said, why are you encouraging my daughter to become pregnant? This is outrageous. Unfortunately, however, the daughter had already purchased the pregnancy test from Target a couple of months earlier. So it was the first disclosure to the father of his daughter's concealed pregnancy. So these sorts of things are rare, but these stories are out there. So in asking questions of researchers, it's important to ascertain that they understand the risks and have the skills necessary to handle the data that they're using. What level of expertise and experience do they have with the creation and use of digital data? If there's limited past experience, do they have a plan to acquire necessary knowledge and skills? And in institutional structures like this, there'll be guidelines and guidance and people to go to. Do the researchers understand the conditions under which the data were created? And have they demonstrated an understanding or approach to the specific ethical issues associated with these data? So this is where we found this was actually quite helpful in just framing what were the issues to spell out and what was the wording that was needed. One of our recommendations was incorporating the perspectives of participants, so ensuring that they had understood what was going on, to know whether they agreed to being approached for renegotiation of extended consent, where there were particular data sets where that was required, to assess their level of understanding of the research project and agreement. So where there are these prolonged, you know, I consent things, can we distill down the few key principles so that those are much clearer and that we can be sure that people did understand those key points? And providing some opportunity for participants to reflect on the experience of research and be sure that, again, what we're doing is socially acceptable, that's part of the whole thing, and do we allow participants to have that say and come back in, and particularly with citizen science and participatory research becoming more and more accessible and part of the research process, I think it's particularly valuable to be able to learn from those opportunities. Just on the technological side, it's important to clarify the techniques that are used to assess privacy and confidentiality. So restricted individual access to data, so you know, logins and passwords and that kind of thing, access control systems that can see if anybody is accessing your server who shouldn't be, looking at ways of aggregating the data or perturbing it to reduce the likelihood of individual loss of privacy, and using de-identified data, but again, in this linkage space, being sure that the linkage process won't allow re-identifiability. There are many data governance and management techniques that can help researchers. So data enclaves are being set up in many areas to help provide some of that access control and governance as a framework. And the Australian Urban Research Infrastructure Network, the ORIN project, is one such example of a portal providing spatially referenced information relevant to urban settings in many different lenses and individuals having access to that information in different levels of granularity and so on, or for different specific projects or sub-themes or data sets. And that way the expertise is there with a group of people whose primary responsibility that is, but there's a way then of accessing and sharing your information through those sorts of services. Data monitoring, there are systems for monitoring access control and seeing if anyone's getting in who shouldn't. Use of a data custodian and clear lines of responsibility, and identifying platforms for secure data creation and storage. So some of these are institutional responsibilities, and one of the ironies that we did identify is that in our fiscally constrained times, many existing in-house systems and solutions that might have been maintained over many years have been outsourced for iCloud and other free storage options, which actually add to the complexity of this because we don't have access to those in-house services anymore. Among the people that we spoke to, there was a lot of interest in, as I say, shared experience. I think it's important that researchers can provide feedback to committees on emerging issues without fear or favour. So certainly at CSIRO, they were able to tell the stories of researchers coming back and saying, we think we need to change the protocol because we've just identified a problem. So being able to have that dialogue, I think, is very important. And same, you know, committee members can share their knowledge and experience and identify lessons learned through different applications. And our recommendation was developing resources for committee members and guidance for researchers. The document that we did prepare has a lot of other links in the back that just provide further information or links to websites or groups of people who are interested in similar issues. And, you know, so we're just one of a number of people with interest in this area who are just trying to get the dialogue going, and what we generated was something very much for consultation and to try to escalate this up to NHMRC and others to say, well, how do we develop better guidance for researchers at a national level to ensure better consistency. The actual guidelines you can get online. So the Carlton Connect initiative funded the research. We had a launch event with the Australian Information Commissioner and Julian Savescu and Craig Butt, who's a data journalist, from The Age. But the actual guidelines can be downloaded from there, and if people are desperate for a paper copy, I have a few here with me. Otherwise, you can download the PDF from that site. It's a nicely slender document. It's not not too big. And if anyone wanted to write the link down, or you can come and see me after. And that's really all that I have to say. I found in the past that this is sort of a topic that tends to open up questions. I, as I say, will bring my own perspective and my shared learning on this area to the discussion, but it's certainly one that we found generated a lot of interest and is highly relevant to many people. Thank you.
Online survey tools. And we have a lot of applications now trying to use like SurveyMonkey and Qualtrics and so on. And we really don't know how to handle that ethically, quite frankly, because these are commercial platforms and people enter confidential data. And I just don't know what to do with that. And I spoke to the statistics unit of the university, which sort of tool they tell us to use or promote. They said SurveyMonkey, and I must say I found that really disappointing. And I just don't know, also not just for Melbourne, but for other universities too around the world, what sort of, I think we need to create our own online survey tool really that's like clearly like only within university owned or whatever. But I think we can't use even Qualtrics. So I went to the Qualtrics platform just to prepare myself for the meeting we had last week. And then straight away I got an email from Qualtrics, Ingrid, do you want to upgrade your account with them? So I felt, here we are. I mean, it's not really a safe environment to enter confidential data, and I just want to get your, maybe somebody else's view on that.
I mean, the person I would... have you spoken to Richard Sinnott at all? So Richard's a head of e-research here. So he's very... privacy, he's the one who I was mentioning. Privacy is really his expertise. But whether there are existing platforms or other solutions that he could recommend...
I've tried to find whatever I can. Qualtrics
yep.
is the one they now recommend, but Qualtrics is also commercial too.
There's one where you have to pay...
That's Qualtrics. It's $500 a month.
Because I was in the in a YEAG as well, and we actually discussed and urged Ori to actually start implementing the own survey tool at the university, also having an own data repository, so having our own cloud platform that you actually can access, because information is owned by any external party that you Google, SurveyMonkey, Dropbox, anything you use. It's not owned by yourself.
And what about cloud store?
It's just
someone else's data repository, and they own your data. Right, because the blurb you get with it is that it's secure and so on. So, and I mean we like it because you can use your university login, so you don't have to sign up to Dropbox or whatever. I thought it was more secure.
Can I just say in there that there are commercially available products out there that universities have licenses with or agreements with, that in certain circumstances when you're using that product they're going to keep things confidential. So Monash University has gone to Google for their email, and the email service that Monash University receives is different, and all the other Google stuff that goes with it is different from what the common person in the street receives. Because we have different levels of privacy and different sort of data that we're storing. I'm wondering if you could approach SurveyMonkey or someone like that and get a particular agreement in place for what it is that you should use that tool for.
But often these American sites, like I think SurveyMonkey and I think also Qualtrics, they are under US legislation.
Yeah, and that's been...
which means NSA.
Yeah, well, because that was one of my biggest concerns. And we looked very carefully into the agreements between Monash and Google, because that is also American, which means it's subject to the Patriot Act.
That's
which
right.
means if Google comes across any sort of information in our emails that they think might be a threat to their national security, then they supposedly the privacy of the individuals involved will be protected.
I think the people to engage locally, so it'd be people like Richard Sinnott and Stephen Manos, who handles the Nectar and the cloud computing services. I think it would be good to speak to them directly and even see if they can present at something like this to provide more expert guidance and solutions.
Contributing and saying things about themselves, and even when, you know, the ethics committee has asked you to warn them that this is public, say it's on Facebook, and be careful about what you put here and whatever, they are often providing a lot of personal health information, for instance. And I found the national statement, you know, it says you must do all these various things to protect anonymity and all of that, but it doesn't really describe what is happening now. Is your next step, I guess, to work with the NHMRC to perhaps start getting some consultation happening around updating the national statement?
That's what we're hoping for, yeah. So escalating that up through our channels in CSIRO and other places to the NHMRC. Because this is covered off on some of the main principles, but there are other issues that come up. I mean, another Facebook one is the use of Facebook in research on students. So if students are actually required to access Facebook for a class and they were never on Facebook before, then, you know, how is that viewed? You know, it's actually that you're compelling them to do it, to have an education, but then there's research in that environment, and that's a particularly grey zone that we're also aware of. Hmm.
But at the same time, I mean, if you think about ethics, I think about these people, but I'm not looking at them as participants, as people. So it's not about their culture, who they are. I don't care. It's about the language they've posted. So what do you say about that?
So, I mean, it comes back to, I mean, at that point, it's what is their consent to, in Facebook terms, so you have to be consistent with the consent they've provided to sharing their information. In terms of the privacy protection, one of the issues that has come up with use of Facebook language, for example, is people posting longer text memes that are then identifiable. You can trace them back to the individual who produced them, so privacy is lost. So that's one of the concerns in that area. But it's been consistent with the original consent. It's about being sure that the way you're using and reporting and analysing the data will protect their privacy. It is a situation where consent has been provided. They have consented to sign up. So it's been consistent with the initial consent. And then protecting privacy and anonymity in your reporting of the data would be, to me, what the main issues are. So it's tricky because you have people, the public-private space is very blurred now.
Yeah. I haven't looked recently, but a few years ago there was some very helpful information available through the Privacy Commission's website. Extending into ideas of what was appropriate and not appropriate.
Yes.
So
it comes down to protection of the privacy of the individual. Even though it's publicly available information, it is still subject to privacy conditions, and so then it's being sure that you have met those conditions and that you are protecting the privacy of individuals. Yep.
One of the things you talk about is allowing individuals to opt out after they've already consented. And one of the issues that we have is that we collect survey data. We do that in a depersonalised way.
Yeah, so this is it. You can't renegotiate consent. Those data might then subsequently be linked with something else, and what if they became re-identifiable, but you can't go back and re-consent them. So it is a challenge.
You have to be able to identify them. So
yeah.
Is it worse to identify them, to be able to let them opt out, or have you completely
this is it. We're all trying to envisage where we're going in research and what the future uses of information might be. And so I guess it's having an approach to planning and thinking through that. But yeah, this is one of the challenges, that we're in such a rapidly changing environment that these questions come up often after the fact, and then we have to work out the best way forward without being able to maybe do the ideal thing. And that's then the value proposition to be discussed.
Can I add to that? It's not an uncommon thing in de-identified registries, and generally when people are told that their data is put on the registry, they're told they don't have the option to opt out because it's de-identified. So if you're in that situation, just make sure you tell people to start it. Once that their data goes into your vault, there is no way to get it out. And that's acceptable.
They also won't be able to access it to correct any information if it's incorrect, as they would if it was named. Yeah.
And sorry, I have just one more question. In terms of where you're actually storing the data, so one of the things that we did is we built a mobile app. Currently that server is a purchase server, so we have a shared server, and we want to store the survey data. Is it appropriate to be storing that on a shared server that's a commercial server, or does it need to be a university server?
Well, certainly in my group, we, being a pretty techie group, have our own servers, and we do can have access control and various things over those. Obviously, they're then backed up through the university, and we don't know exactly everywhere the university backs up to, but we govern it as far as we can. So I think having, you know, and this is something, this is an infrastructure issue for universities, and as I say, we're aware that this university used to have various systems that it's now deconstructed, so that's why I think some of these solutions are best discussed with the people in charge of those systems and infrastructure, because there are newer solutions. None of them will be completely perfect, but they will still be best practice for the present environment. Particularly with spatially referenced data, it's a whole new can of worms.
Yeah, and the controls of data, legal data, I think it's very problematic.
I think it's good of showing that the ABC article with this will, you actually can get quite a lot of information about his personal life. If you start linking all these different data points that, you know, whom is he calling, you can find out which one is a work contact, which one is a private contact, where does he actually live, where do his work contacts live. So it's actually quite scary, and I don't know, when we access, when we review ethics applications where people use digital data, I think what we also try to imagine is, how do you as a participant feel if someone is observing your phone calls, accessing your emails all the time?
But a lot of that is in the process of research. Maybe you're educating people that this is already out there. So, I mean, that wasn't changed by the process of engaging in the research.
No.
And that's the wider social dialogue. So, you know, as I say, people say privacy is out of the bag, but how do we then work with participants to protect their privacy in the context of research? It's, we can't undo all those other things.
You said there are less incidents with research with incidents on confidentiality and using digital data, because researchers actually don't access it the way private corporations do, or what they do that is just actually earning money, whereas you try to do answer some questions to solve human problems. And I think that's the only reason why we didn't have any incidents yet.
Well, it's preventing those inadvertent harms that might arise, yeah. I mean, certainly the geomatics professor never pays for his Mikey card with anything but cash, because he doesn't want his bank account linked to his travel. not that he's dodgy, but, you know, it's just a little bit of knowledge and you start wondering whether you actually do want all of these pieces of information together.
And actually, that, I think, is another issue of data literacy.
Mm.
That could be, yes. I think, a really, you mentioned science, citizen science, but I think data literacy could be a really important area, actually, for all of us at Cross University, maybe, to, you know.
What's it? I can't convince my sister. My sister refuses to buy anything with a credit card online, and I can't convince her that when she goes into a shop, that's an online transaction. You know, what do you think? How does the bank know that you just paid for this?
It's really one metadata about everyone is out there writing data. Most people are actually not aware of what you can read about a person. So I agree. Maybe that could be incorporated in the guidelines or something that, like you said.
Well, we wrote these specifically for researchers and ethics committees, but, you know, we sort of, if we went somewhere next, it would be how do we increase the community dialogue, and Sydney City of Melbourne was one of our partners and they were keen to have that that role. But also for, I can't remember who else, oh, for politics, for government and those sorts of...
It would be great if, I know it's a huge task, but it would be great if actually for each discipline, and each discipline has different needs, to actually drill down on some problems, in medicine, in social science, in arts, in creative arts or music, where you actually access that type of data to provide recommendations on how to answer research ethics-specific questions and recommended softwares or tools that, you know, I think that's what most here at the uni read these guidelines and tried to work with it, but it's still so hard to actually implement that into all these projects that come to you. Still an open box with lots of question marks, and I think really miniature percentage was we were able to answer with those.
Maybe building on that, I mean, if I just picture our ethics like form, people have to tick nothing of this as well. I mean, a bit of data, but it's like semi-structured interview observation. I mean, is this observation or what is it? So we really don't know, and I think that's really the next step. We really need to update.
So I totally agree with you, but I think it is important that it's a cross-disciplinary conversation and not a discipline-specific one, because I think that is very informative, and part of the challenge is helping the different disciplines to understand each other's perspective, because I think that is a learning exercise. There's also an opportunity here in that I'm involved with a new Data Systems and Society Research Network, and there are other platforms that have been set up, I know, in the social sciences to help information sharing and digital technologies. So maybe that's something I can take back to the steering group and say, well, here's a very practical use of this network, is to try to get the researchers and ethics committees together who are asking these questions to really work on what are the usable platforms and systems, and how can we give people the skills or technologies to best approach this. That's the interest. And then you start talking to the data journalists, and you're saying, well, isn't what you're doing research? And they're, oh, we're journalists. We work by the journalistic code of conduct. And so, you know, how far do some of these principles extend? I think that's a really interesting question. You know, where are the grey zones? Okay. Thank you.